And we're in Revelation chapter 17, and we left off at verse 9 last time, and this is when the angel that appeared to John and is showing him these things, and in this chapter, showing him this woman that is riding on this beast, and this woman being that great Babylon, that beast that upon which she was riding had seven heads and ten horns, and this angel is now revealing the mystery of that. So that's the point where we've reached in our study here, Revelation 17. So starting in verse 9, the angel's going to reveal the mystery of this. Let's read verses 9 through 13, Brother Glenn, if you would, and we'll start trying to go through that.
Here is the mind which hath wisdom, seven heads and seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings, five are fallen and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. Ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings, 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast.
Okay, so let me get my markers. This is the Okay, so we'll have to go without markers tonight. at any rate, so seven heads and ten horns of this beast. And here is the mind which has wisdom. One of the points that we emphasized last time was the general point there. The mind that has wisdom is going to listen to what God has to say, not just about this, but about everything. The mind that has wisdom is not going to lean to its own understanding or listen to the wisdom of men in any way. We need to listen to what God has to say, otherwise we're not going to understand anything properly. So here's God revealing what this is about through this angel. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And the woman, of course, is the city. So here's a city that sits on seven hills. Now, of course, a lot of people have tried to tie that to Rome. Again, could that be? Certainly. But also, again, as we have noted many times, is it the mind that has wisdom? Are we going to try to define something very specifically here and then eliminate the possibility that this could be something that could have applications numerous times or over and over again even. I mean, the points that are being taught by it, whether this is Rome, includes Rome, or not, are points that are very important and valid and applicable to every time in which any Christian would live, including our own. These are timeless principles that he's teaching here about good and evil and God's judgment of wickedness, and also how the devil works in this world and how we can overcome.
We got one anyway.
All right, so we have the, it's not the best one, but it'll work. Okay, so here, the woman, which is the city, the beast upon which she's riding, you have these seven mountains. And then he says there are seven kings. So we have seven used in two different applications there. Seven mountains and seven kings. So the city sits on seven mountains, and there are seven kings. Well, are these, what city or what kingdom has seven kings at once? Well, that's not something you typically see. But he says five are fallen. So is he talking about all these are ruling at the same time? No, five are already done. And then he says that one is and the other is not yet come. Well, that really fits what he already told us about the beast earlier in this chapter. Just a couple of verses back up when he introduced this beast. And in verse 8, he says, "The beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition." And then at the end of verse 8 says, "The beast that was and is not and yet is." So he's already used some of this language to talk about the past, present, and future concerning this beast, when what's going to happen to it. But it really relates pretty well to that, what he says there about those kings in verse 10. Five are fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. So based on the language of verse 8, this beast's power, the day of this beast, is it, or its day is numbered? Very much so. As he says, it's it was and is not. But the fact is, it was, even though it is not in the sense it's going to come to an end, not quite yet, because it says was and is not and yet is. Well, there's one king to come, he says. But out of seven, one is yet not yet come. I mean, again, it tells us that whoever this is, it's coming. This is coming to an end here. So here are the seven kings. Five are done. One is. The other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. So there was going to be that king and then for a short time. And then he says in verse 11, "The beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goes into perdition." That's a little bit tricky to sort out, because here the beast has these seven heads that are these seven kings, but the beast himself is the eighth that are of those seven. So evidently, I mean, there's obviously some tie, whether it's the sequence, but it's it's related to those other seven that came before it. So here, the beast is king number eight. Okay, now there are plenty of people that write stuff to speculate on all this. Okay, the five kings are, and then surmise what that one that is, and then the one that has not yet come, and then what the eighth one. Speculating, surmising, guessing, we're not going to do that. We can, there are other passages, particularly, we can go back to, for example, we're not going to do it right now, but if we were studying the book of Daniel right now, there's several of the passages where he identifies horns, which are very often associated with rulers, kings, very specific about naming different kingdoms and describing the time frames and events that would take place. Just for example, when you read in Daniel 8 with the that beast that had the two horns, and then one was more notable that came up second, the kingdom of the Medes and Persians that he names there, and then the kingdom of Greece that that conquers that one, that rough goat, And then it has a notable horn between its eyes, and which is the first of its kings. Well, when it, and he names it as Persia. Well, what was the first king of Persia? What was the first? I mean, Greece. What was the first Grecian king that conquered Persia? I mean, when you have it spelled out like that, I mean, we're not going off into fantasy land to say, well, from history we know there's Alexander the Great. I mean, that's who it was. I mean, and he tells us and. With everything essentially but the name. And there are a lot of passages like that in Daniel that are very specific with details so that it makes it pretty easy to know. I mean, like Nebuchadnezzar, thou art the head of gold. I mean, when we have those kinds of statements, we're not off into the land of speculation and imagination when he's telling us things like that. But he doesn't do that here. He does not identify this woman and say, this woman is, well, he says Babylon the Great, which is the symbol, because the figurative name for the city, because Babylon herself is long gone at this point. So figuratively she's Babylon, but do we have a literal defining of any city here? No, we don't. And therefore, any rulers of this city that the Lord does not specifically or explicitly define for us, we don't. It's not like the situation in Daniel where we have, based on the Lord's statements, a very easy path to understand what those rulers or who those rulers are. It's not like that here. So to try to fill in that with the woman, the beast, the kings here, we have nothing else other than what we just read there. We can't tie anything specific to this without using our imaginations. We don't have any other statements to go by to point us in a particular direction, which is why I'm not going to do that. What if I'm wrong? I mean, maybe I make a lucky guess, but what if I'm wrong? And I'm telling you, here's who this is. Now, again, I've mentioned a number of times, this was written to people that lived in the time of Rome. Is it possible that there's application to that for them in that time? Certainly so. I'm not going to say that it can't be that, but I'm not going to tie it to that, nor am I going to say it's limited to that, or try to name or define any of these like that, and say, well, this king would be this one and that one. I mean, if this were Rome, I mean, Rome had far more than that many kings. This would just be impossible to, without any other statements from the Lord about what this is, to try to pin that down and define it with any accuracy. And without going to great risk that we are adding to what the Lord says there. And besides, even if we were to know it, even we could list these seven and say this one is this, 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 and this, would that change for us the meaning of any of this? And what we learn from what he's teaching there about these principles about good and evil and how God judges in the world? It wouldn't change any of that. Might that be why the Lord didn't write it in such a way where we can, whether he intended for it to be something that was one thing for one time? I mean, he didn't tell us. So what we are left with are the things he does tell us, which are timeless principles. And that's what we're learning, and anything beyond that wouldn't change what we need to understand from it. Because this is what we do know is this is a city, and it's a wicked city. It's a city that has spread wickedness. It's a city that is a source of persecution. And it's a city whose days are numbered, because God's going to judge her for her wickedness like he did Babylon, which is why he says she is the figurative Babylon. So all those things that we saw back there in the Old Testament about that Babylon, we can see the descriptions of this city in the same way, and here's the judgment of God against this wickedness. That's what's relevant. All right, so as we look at it then, We have all those kings. And then you have the ten horns. Now here with the ten horns.
So here are the seven heads here. Seven mountains and seven kings. And then the beast is king number eight. But then you have the ten horns, which are ten kings.
So we got a bunch more kings there. All right, so he says in verse 12, these are these ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now there have been plenty that have tried to make a comparison with the style of Roman rule when, for example, in the land of Judea. All right, who did Jesus appear before in his trials on his last night on this earth? Well, it was an unusual situation at that time, as far as the rulership of the Jews from Jerusalem, because you had Annas and Caiaphas. You had a father-in-law and son-in-law that were identified as high priests. So Jesus appeared before both of them initially. So that itself was a bit unusual that you had essentially a father-in-law and a son-in-law that both were recognized in the role of high priest. So that was outside of the norm. There were a lot of things outside of the norm for what the leaders of the Jews were doing in that time, as seen by that very night and what was going on there. But first Jesus appeared before the high priest, then he was sent to whom? The Roman governor, Pilate. And then who was he sent to after that, before he was sent back to Pilate, after which then he was crucified? One other one that we haven't mentioned, was that Michael? Herod, yes, Herod. Well, who was Herod? Who were the Herods? Herod was really a title. And there were several of them. The one known to history is Herod the Great. He was the one that refurbished the Second Temple and expanded it greatly and added many stones. I mean, it was a very elaborate and expensive project from what the original building was there. He was known for that. So when the disciples showed Jesus those beautiful stones of the temple, I mean, he was showing them the work that Herod the Great had done. Well, there had those Herods. I mean, that was a family. In John the Baptist's time, that came into that came into play as far as what happened to John. I mean, eventually you had a splitting, and you had several in the family that had principalities within the region of the Jews. The different ones ruled, so you had Herodias, who was the wife of the Herod there with where John the Baptist was, but he had a brother, Philip, whom Herodias had been married to first, and now she was married to his brother. And that was not lawful, as John the Baptist pointed out. That's adultery. And that's what got him in trouble and cost him his head. I mean, those were the Herods. Jesus appeared before Herod in that trial, as he was hoping to see some miracle done of Christ. And it says that Pilate and Herod became friends. They'd been at enmity with each other before that, but then they became friends after that occasion. What an occasion to have a bond of friendship from. But at any rate, those Herods, I mean, they had... they had rulership in that area, but could they do anything they wanted? Well, as Jesus was sent to Herod, he was sent back to Pilate. Why? What was the situation there? I mean, how did that work? And what was that a reflection of as far as the Roman style of rulership?
The Romans definitely left things to
Yep.
We're already in place to handle the affairs of the world.
And how would you, and that's actually was prophesied in Daniel chapter 2 with that image that Nebuchadnezzar was given in his vision that Daniel the prophet was given the interpretation to. So he revealed the dream and the interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. Then you had the breast and arms of silver, which was the Persian Empire. And then you had the belly and thighs of brass, the Greeks. And then you had the legs of iron, and the feet partly iron mixed with clay. And when that was explained in Daniel 2, it said that that fourth kingdom, which was the Romans, it would be a king that was partly strong and partly broken. And that was the way they did rule. So there was even prophecy of that. And that's what's so amazing about Daniel. And by the way, I know I've referred to Daniel a couple of times in here tonight, but Daniel is so detailed in its prophecies. That causes great problems for people who don't believe the Word of God, as well it should, as the Lord has designed it to. So what do you think that unbelievers did for so long to try to get around their problem of having such detailed prophecies of events that are known very well to history in all its detail, where you have an exact matching up of everything? There's no way that could be of man. So how do people try to get around it? Well, what they said, well, then it was obviously this was written after it happened. So what they did was claim that the claimed time frame of the authorship of the book of Daniel, they said, was false. It really wasn't by Daniel the prophet written in the time of when Daniel lived, but rather somebody claimed Daniel's name, and it was really written after all those things happened. You know what fixed or exposed that lie? The Dead Sea Scrolls that date back into 400 BC and beyond. Guess what they found entire copies of in the midst of all that? How do you explain the entire book of Daniel being in existence in a cave that dates back to Daniel's time? So that they got real quiet about that, because there you go. You've got proof that Daniel was written before those things happened. What does that mean? That is from God. There's no question about it. The evidence for that is astounding, and is something that should be joyous to us. But anyway, when he's describing the Roman Empire well in advance and the style in which they would even rule, and we know that that's what happened. We have the evidence in the time of Christ and John the Baptist and the others in the apostles in the New Testament. So we get to read about that. You had the Herods. I mean, the Romans allowed them to have their palaces, to have their little principalities, to exercise their rulership and to do all those things. The Romans were quite happy to leave the details up to people like that to govern a land. Their interest was not in personally trying to be involved in every detail of the governance of the lives of all of those areas that they conquered. What were the Romans interested in? Mainly two things. Well, of course, the one thing that everybody's interested in above all others, money. I mean, what was the way for a local ruler to keep the Romans happy? I mean, they really had two things to do: make sure that the tax money flowed to the Romans and that the peace was kept. And as long as there was no rebellion, as long as there was no where you had any threat to any kind of armed threat to the Romans, they were quite happy. As long as it was that way, if you had peace and taxes, Romans were happy. And that's the way they governed their kingdom. Now, there's some people that would somewhat of a parallel to that, perhaps, in that description of those kings there, the ten horns in verse 12. It says they've received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. I mean, that's possible. But that Romans aren't the only ones that have or even into modern times, follow that type of style. So this is something, again, that we can see repeats of. So that's why we can certainly say that leaves open the possibility that that can include Rome. But we can also have to be open to, well, that could also include some other great cities or kingdoms that are wicked and are going, that have or will face the Lord's judgment. So at any rate, these are 10 kings. Certainly from the description of verse 12, they have power. They receive authority, but where do they get it from? And do they really have their own kingdom as such? Not the way he's describing it there. And he says they have one mind and will give their power and strength to the beast. So was there going to be anything in it for the beast to give these rulers their power? Well, yes, there's got to be something in it for him. And there is. So they get power and strength from those ones that are ruling at the beast's behest there. So it's just showing the reciprocal relationship when you have an overall power that allows others to rule under them. I mean, that no powerful kingdom or nation or ruler is going to allow others under them to rule without getting something out of it, without benefiting from it. And again, I mean, the Romans aren't the only ones that did that. I mean, we can certainly, I mean, we can look at situations on earth today. Yeah, right now, that's very much like that. You know, we even use the terms like somebody's puppet state. You know, you have a lot of these smaller nations, and you know, they have their rulers and everything, but a lot of times there's somebody big behind them, as long as they're toeing the line, they'll be fine. But there's going to be some advantage for that bigger power. So he's really describing something much along those lines there. All right, but then we get to the key point in verse 14. So let's go ahead and let's go ahead and read 14 to 18. Let's see, Brother Michael, can you read that for us?
He shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and favorable. He said unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the four sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the war, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which ran before the kings of the earth.
All right, so here's where it comes down to the key points from all of this. And the key points is not trying to figure out or define, well, I think this king is, this horn is this king, and with this name and all of that. No, this city is a wicked place, a source of great wickedness, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth is what is written on her head there, along with mystery of Babylon the Great, going back to verse 5. But here's this beast upon which she sits, these seven mountains. And you have these kings that are symbolized from the heads and horns. But then we have that description of the way in which this kingdom operated. But here's what happened. Verse 14. These rulers, which don't have their power on their own, the beast is behind it and upon which this woman sits. So the one above all this is this wicked city. But all of these other places that are receiving power from her, and also being influenced by her with all that wickedness. What are they doing as far as dealing with God's people? I mean, this is a description of the world. When he's describing this woman and all these other kings around that receive power there. I mean, here he's describing the world. And what is this world doing with, or how is this world responding to the Lord and to God's people? Well, here these kings, he says in verse 14, are making war with the Lamb. Well, do they make war directly? And who's the Lamb? I mean, this goes back to chapter 5. I mean, this is Christ. He is the Lamb. He's the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Well, and of course we know that going back to chapter 12, where we saw the dragon, Satan, and he's the one that gives power to the beast in chapter 13, that have a description with the heads and horns, the Satan himself and the first beast in chapter 13 that line up with this beast. I mean, this is wickedness. This is evil here. Satan's behind all of this. Well, how does Satan fight Christ? Well, here Satan is using the ones that he has deceived, these ones on this earth. And these ones on the earth, these kings, these other nations, like we saw the beasts in chapter 13, as they were making war against God's people, they do this by persecuting the followers of Christ. So how does Satan make war with Christ? He has his people attacking the Lord's people. I mean, how is Satan going to directly fight Christ, who has all authority in heaven and earth? What he does is goes after his people, which is exactly what Jesus said would happen. They persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If that's what happened to the master, what's going to happen to the servants? Let's go back and read that. Keeping your mark there in Revelation chapter 18, back to Matthew chapter 10. Verses 24 let's go down through 24 through 28 there, Matthew 10. See, Brother Stephen, can you read that for us?
The disciple is not above his master, but a servant above his Lord. It is enough for the disciple that he be as the master, and the servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house of Beelzebub, how much more shall they call him his household? Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known. But I tell you, darkness, that speak ye in light, and what ye hear in the ear, that preach ye on the housetop. And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell.
So the principle in verse 24 is that the disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. Well, who's the Lord? Who's our Lord and Master? Is Jesus Christ. What happened to him? Well, he mentions it in verse 25. Did they call the master of the house Beelzebub? Mm-hmm. Well, if they would call him that, are they going to call us anything? Most certainly. Well, should we then be afraid of them? No, he says not. He says we need to be afraid of the one who has the true power, especially over our souls. Now, what man can do anything with our soul? And what we're seeing in Revelation chapter 17 right now, this woman, the beast, those horns or kings, in making war with the Lamb, what power did any of them have over the souls of the followers of the Lamb? All we've read about from chapter 12, when we were first introduced to that dragon there, as he was making war against the seed of that woman in chapter 12, and those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, does it mention anything about him having power over their souls to do anything to their soul? Now, he brings temptation upon us. We give in to the temptation, and then our souls become in jeopardy. But can the devil make us do anything? No. God doesn't allow that. He does not allow us to be tempted above what we can bear. He provides a way of escape from every temptation. He's faithful to do that. So the devil doesn't have a free hand. He can't make us do something. He entices us, tempts us, does everything he can to encourage us to do it, but he can't force us to do it. Could he? How badly did Satan want Job to curse God? He wanted that badly. As God said, "Have you considered my servant Job, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil?" Of course he had considered him, and he wanted him, but then he complained, "Well, you've put a hedge around him, I can't touch him." So then he said, "Okay, you can touch everything he has, but you can't touch him." Because Satan was accusing Job of only serving God for his things. He said, "You take it away, he's going to curse you." How badly did Satan want Job to curse God? He wanted that victory. If he could have made Job do it, what would he have done? He would have made Job do it. Now, God permitted him to touch all that Job had. Did he take his children? Did he take all of his animals? Did he destroy all that he had? And then later, when he was given power over his body, but not over his life, did he touch his body? Grievously, he did what he could do, but only as a means to tempt Job, but he couldn't force Job to turn his back on God to curse him. And Job didn't. In all of that, he didn't sin with his lips nor charge God foolishly. If Satan could have forced Job to sin with his lips and charge God foolishly, he would have done it. But he couldn't make him do that. Job resisted it. Well, in chapter 12, Satan made war against the Lord's people, but he couldn't make them do anything. He couldn't make them go to hell. And in chapter 13, when the beast, the first beast, and then the false prophet, that second beast, when they were persecuting and killing Christians, the next scene at the beginning of chapter 14, they're standing on Mount Zion with the Lamb. What power did those beasts have over the souls of those ones they were even killing for their faith in Christ? Zero power over their souls. Who was standing victorious in the end? And who was standing victorious in chapter 15 on that sea of glass, having the harps of God singing the new song? The ones who had gotten the victory over the beast. What power did Satan and all those that he was using have to be able to destroy the souls of Christ's followers? Who only has power over our soul to put our soul anywhere in eternity? God alone. That's who we should fear. That's who we should seek and serve. And we shouldn't be afraid of men. He's teaching us there. But with all that, he's letting us know there will be problems for our body sometimes. It can be severe. There's going to be persecution. He's very clear on that, because we're not greater than he is, and he went through it. So that was the point that Christ was making there. He made that point again in the Gospel of John in chapter 15. He even refers back to what we were just reading there in Matthew chapter 10. In verses 18 through 20. We'll say 21, 18 to 21, Brother Ted. John 15, 18 to 21.
"But the world hates you. You know that he hated you before it hates you. If you were of the world was not his own, but because we are not the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hated you.
All right. Well, if we were of the world, if we had the mark of the beast, using the language of Revelation, if we had his mark on us, well, what happened to the ones who did in Revelation that he was describing there? Did they have any problem from the world, or any problem from Satan? They could buy and sell. They could go about and do whatever. They belonged to the world. They were identified as such. That's the mark. If we were of the world would love us. But he says, because we're not of the world, because he's chosen us out of the world, we don't have that mark there. What happens then? He says, therefore the world hates you. That's exactly what we were reading in Revelation chapter 13. That hatred of the world for God's people. That's exactly what we're reading here at this point of Revelation 17. Making war with the Lamb. They don't know God. And they hate whoever is not like them. And that would be God's people. And he said in verse 20, remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. That's what we just read in Matthew 10 a moment ago. So he's reminding him of what he had said back then. We're not greater than he is. He was persecuted. He was called Beelzebub. We're going to be railed against and persecuted. And he said, if they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. I mean, that's just the bottom line. They did persecute him. They will persecute us. The world is going to make war against God's people. It's Satan going after the Lamb by going after his people to try to destroy him. He's that roaring lion seeking to devour us. Well, those things that we're reading here, Matthew 10, John 15, and we could look at a lot of other passages of Scripture in the New Testament on that particular subject, but what he's describing there in Revelation 17 and verse 14, as these shall make war with the Lamb, that's what that's about. That's what that's describing. That's why that woman was drunk off of the blood of the saints, the martyrs of Jesus. But who wins? Verse 14. Now somebody might say, well, if she's drunk off the blood of them, it sounds like they lost. Well, they lost what? And going back to Matthew 10. Fear not who's able to kill your body. Don't be afraid of the one that might be drunk off your blood. As graphic as that is, who does he say be afraid of? The one that can put body and soul in hell. She couldn't do that. This beast can't do that. Satan can't do that. So they make war with the Lamb, and they may have victories over bodies of these people, but what happens with the Lamb? He says, the Lamb shall overcome them. There's that word overcome again. It's one of the key words. I feel bold enough to say, when I read the book, the way it states it in all those letters to the seven churches, when we see chapter 21 and verse 7, who will inherit all things? He that overcomes will inherit all things. Every promise in those all seven of those letters to the churches in Asia, in chapters 2 and 3, to him that overcomes. We see that emphasis. We saw it in chapter 15, the one standing on the sea of glass. These are the ones that got the victory. That's the overcome. This is all that word Nike. In Greek, the word for overcome, victory. And when it comes down to Satan fighting against the Lord, who wins? The Lamb. That is the very reason why he makes the statement that he does in 1 John chapter 4. And this was written to Christians, again, who were being persecuted, because all Christians are. But in 1 John chapter 4, and verse 4, what does he have to say about this? Let's see, Brother Dave.
Ye are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world.
Well, who's in us? Christ abides in us. Who's in the world? Who's the prince of this world? Who's greater? The one that's in us or the one that's in this world? Another way of asking it within the framework of what we're reading here in Revelation I mean, who's greater, the lamb or the dragon? The lamb. If we're following the lamb, what's going to happen? We'll overcome. We'll win. They're the ones that got the victory over the beast in chapter 15. They're the ones standing on the sea of glass, having the harps of God, singing that new song. That's the way. If we are following him, that's where it leads. That's one of the big points. Again, really the key point of Revelation. Overcoming. All that temptation is going to be there, and the devil is it. He brings temptation with force. When it comes with persecution, here's the Lord's way, and here's what's going to happen to you if you keep following that way you're following. You're going to hurt for this. You're going to be ostracized. You're going to be called names. You're going to be physically hurt. You may be killed for doing that. You get off that path, you come over here, all that stops. All you're going to have is love from the world then. No more of that persecution. I mean, that makes it sound very easy, doesn't it? You just get right off, get off that straight, narrow road. And that's what that narrow, it's straight means, it's not with a G-H-T. It's that pressured, that word for like the a straight, like the Straits of Magellan. And there are other places on this earth where you have those, the Straits of Gibraltar. Those are areas that are treacherous for ships to pass. Rocky areas, very tight places to pass. You get those narrow channels, and it's a very dangerous place. That's the word. That's the word for that road that we're on. It's a narrow, pressured way because of what the devil's doing to us. It's not the easy road. Where in all this are we reading about how it's going to be an easy life to follow Christ? Where does he say that? Now, Jesus says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. He's not burdening us. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4, when he tells us, he says, my commandments are not grievous. They're not heavy. He doesn't load on us a heavy load. It doesn't come from him. The devil makes our road hard. But Jesus provides the way through all of that where we will be victorious in the end. He never says that being following him is going to be an easy way. It was not. That's why he said, when somebody said, Lord, I'll go where, whithersoever you go. Foxes have holes. Who's got the den? The birds. Anyway, the Son of Man had not where to lay his head. Not easy. You follow me, it's going to be a rough life. But if all we're thinking about is right now, well, that's why I said, then we're of all men most miserable. But since there's a resurrection of the dead, since there's a light to come that's eternal in duration, this light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal way to glory. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory which shall be revealed. Those are the statements he makes. There is no comparison for what we go through now to what's going to happen for us in that victory that we're going to attain. The prize is going to come from our overcoming. The reward that will be there to him that overcomes will be able to inherit all things. So that's why we see there are times when he tells us very plainly the way it's going to be here and now. And we can see that from the description throughout this book, from beginning all the way here, and it's going to go to the end. This life's going to be very, very hard for us as followers of Christ. We're going to have persecution. There's going to be tribulation. Our faith is going to be tried. But it's not going to be any temptation above what we can bear. The Lord's going to provide the way of escape. And in the end, we see who's victorious. And in the end, we see who's defeated. All the glimpses of just the here and now, you might think, well, this doesn't look good for us. I mean, that's, you can look at chapter 13. Looks like the beast and his followers are winning. But then what did we see? Who received those seven last plagues in chapter 16? They did. They weren't there standing in on Mount Zion with the Lamb in chapter 14 and verse 1. They weren't part of the redeemed of the earth. They weren't there on that sea of glass with the harps of God in chapter 15. Only the ones who'd gotten the victory that had overcome were there. All those who follow Christ will be there. Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. That's the only way to be victorious in the end and for our souls to be saved. That's what matters. That was the point of Matthew 10 that we were reading, is where this ends up in the end. That's why Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Whatever happens to us here and now, our concern has to be with that part of us that is eternal in nature and where we're going to spend our eternity. If we follow the Lamb, that's the way of victory. Those who fight the Lamb, those who don't follow the Lamb, it's defeat. And that's going to get very graphic in chapter 19. All these ones in that war with the Lamb, they're going to fall. It's going to be a slaughter. You can't win over Christ. The only way to win is by following Christ. And so the Lamb will overcome then. For he is Lord. We're back in Revelation 17, verse 14. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. So here are these kings with whatever authority they have trying to use that power against God's people. Can laws be brought to bear against Christians to make it illegal for us to do the things that God commands us to do? Can that happen? Ask Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Certainly can. Why did Moses flee Egypt and go out to Midian and spend 40 years out there? It wasn't for how, because that was a great place for a 40-year respite. He fled from the authorities for his life. But that can happen. And sadly, there are times when it does happen. There have been some winds blowing in our own nation in the time that gives us reason to be concerned. Very good reason to pray about that. We don't want to just assume what we've had is always going to continue. We've had great blessings in this land to not have that sort of thing. We've never tasted that here, like what we read about in Scripture. And that's not a bad thing to pray for. In fact, we're commanded to pray for that we can live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. The Lord tells us to pray for that. But that doesn't mean that's going to be for any one of us or all of us or for all time. There are times when it is the Lord's will that these things happen, and even the power of governments are turned against Christians. That's exactly what was happening in the time when Revelation was written, when Domitian was the emperor of Rome, and he made the worship of himself compulsory throughout the empire. That was the cause of this empire-wide persecution against Christians, because they wouldn't do it. So that's the very circumstance in which this is being written. So for Christians to read about kings wielding their power against the followers of the land, that they were tasting that personally. The one that was being inspired with these words was a prisoner on an island for the same reason at this very time. So that certainly happens. But it's a reminder to them, you keep following the Lamb, just like he wrote to the church at Smyrna, Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. So he's showing the crown of life, the victory and overcoming. Because here are these kings with whatever power, but which king is above all kings? He is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And he says, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Look at that description of the followers of the Lamb. If we're not those things, are we really followers of the Lamb, and are we going to be victorious in the end? That's something. We'll chew on that for the next week. We need to chew on that for the rest of our lives, of course, and make sure we are that. But we'll try to look into that a little bit more, Lord willing, at the beginning of our time together studying next Wednesday night. So we'll stop for now, as we're out of time.